on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, here's KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Portfolio Manager, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, March 9th, 2015 edition of InvestTalk. And I'd like to welcome all of our listeners listening on investtalk.com, those listening online via investtalk.com, our podcast listeners, and our terrestrial listeners listening up and down California as well. Now, as professional investors, we have a rule that we do not invest in companies that do not make money. But just because a company is profitable doesn't mean it's necessarily a good investment. Right? There's multiple factors that make a company good and multiple factors that make a company bad. And there are many different ways one can assess a company's profitability. And the four profit measures are important tools in measuring a company's health and potential going forward. It's very important to figure out how a company makes money and what are the risks to that. Now, there's return on assets. And when calculating return on equity, which is a very, very popular way to assess a company's profitability, you first have to start with return on assets. You measure that first. And then once the ROA, return on assets, is determined, then you find the amount of financial leverage a company has, meaning how much debt does it have compared to how much money investors have put into it, right? And that can give you a good sense of where the profit is coming from. If a company is highly leveraged, right, and their return equity is high, but they're highly leveraged, they have a lot of debt, well, their return assets can be low and still be very profitable when you're measuring return equity. But it could also mean a higher degree of risk for that particular company because of that. So when you're looking at return on equity, it's not all treated the same. So this is just a good example of how you need to understand what you're looking at. It's not just about knowing, okay, well, return on equity is a profitability measure. Okay, fully understanding that is important. Same with if you're looking at maybe margins, right? Well, are they gross margins, net margins? And how are those margins made up? What is the difference between gross margins and net margins? Do you know that? Do you know the difference between industries? Some industries, the gross margin is very close to the net margin. Some industries, they're very different because there's a lot more, there's a lot of other activities involved, right? In a sales type of business, gross margins and net margins usually are pretty close. When it comes to product business, gross margins and net margins tend to be very, very different. Okay? So, what does that mean? Do you understand that and why that is? So these are four measures, and these are really the best way one can get a good snapshot of how well a company is performing from an operating perspective. Return assets, return equity, gross margins, net margins. All these figures go into the analysis of how well a company performs in the context to its peers. Because remember, return equity in one industry is not always similar in another. In the software industry, usually margins, return on assets, return equity, those tend to be a lot higher. Which is why you'll pay up for those type of businesses. Premium over maybe a company that has low margins, low return on assets. So you always have to look for firms with improving or steady profitability. But as with any fundamental measure, it's just one factor that must be taken into context with dozens of others in order to make a sound investment choice. So That's what we're all taught. What we're all about: helping you make better investment decisions. Now, Apple came out with their highly anticipated Apple Watch, and Apple usually has the magic touch with technology, engaging the market for the next best thing. Will they score again this time? Remember, this is kind of the first product from Steve Jobs, from Tim Cook. Is it going to be a hit? I think this is going to be a good test of whether or not Apple can continue to come out with great products without Steve Jobs in the mix, in development. Now, as an investor, should you anticipate success and bet on the outcome? Is it cautious? Is it better to be cautious? What's your thinking? Now, Invest Talk is all about answering your questions, but we want to hear your opinions too. We are live 4 to 5 Pacific time. Our number is 888-99-CHART. I hope you use it and give me a call sooner rather than later. We still have about 45 minutes left on the show, but it goes by quick. So try to get in to ask your questions sooner rather than later. So let's take this question from our 24-hour listener line first.
I wanted to know, I hear a lot of radio programs advertising gold for sale, and it seems like they don't have a brick-and-mortar building to go to, and I hesitate to purchase stuff over a radio advertisement like that. And they don't normally, you don't normally see those companies listed on the stock market that you can invest in per se. What do you do in a case like that if you want to invest in gold, but you don't feel comfortable in the A, investing in, you know, so stock mining companies, and B, these companies that sell it over the radio? Thank you.
Well, I would say find a brick and mortar, just because the ones you're hearing on the radio or TV may not have brick and mortar locations. I guarantee you unless you live in middle of nowhere, you're going to have some sort of brick and mortar store within a half hour drive of you. There are plenty out there. So, I mean, I would go online, search Yelp, search from review sites and Google it. I mean, to be frank, I mean, there's plenty out there. I know the ones on TV and radio, a lot of them don't have brick and mortar stores. So I get what you're saying. A lot of them are very reputable. So I would do a lot of research online, try to find people who've done business with those businesses, whether it's a brick and mortar store, maybe even some online ones that have great reputations. You know, I've never bought a physical gold and silver, except for maybe a few gold coins here and there over my lifetime. But you know, I prefer investing it into miners who pay a dividend. That's what I like anyway. Now, are you betting yourself? Are you beating yourself by trying to beat the market? Maybe you need to change your mind about investing. It's one of our talking points today. I'm going to talk about behavior. Four ways to beat your investing bias. And a lot of people fall victim to groupthink, they fall victim to their biases, and I'm going to talk about four ways that you can be self-aware. Right? What does the average person think about when talking about investment success? What is good, right? What is a good investment? What are the things that you look at to know whether it's a good investment? The vast majority of people look at the wrong things. So we're going to talk about why they look at the wrong factors to assess whether an investment is good or bad. Nearly two-thirds of people think that their financial sophistication is advanced, but they score an average of 61% on financial literacy tests, which is basically failing on average. So I would say the majority of people probably miss half of the questions on that financial literacy test. It's probably a small subset that really boosted that score. So what this is talking about is what people think about their knowledge, what they think they should do to make sure they're making good investments. But in reality, what they really, the mindset they should really have to be successful. So I want to touch on that. I think that's very important. Always having the right mindset in anything, I think, is a number one to success. If you have the wrong mindset, it doesn't really matter what type of knowledge you gain, people you talk to. If you're starting from the wrong place, you're going to end in, you know, to me, a mindset is about the path that you're taking. So if your mindset's wrong, means your path that you're taking is wrong, and you're going to end up in the wrong place. So starting with the right mindset is very important. So we're going to talk about that. I also want to talk about the Apple Watch announcement today. What are some things you need to know about it? And I think there was an even more interesting, I don't say maybe not more, but equally as interesting piece of the announcement today that people aren't really talking about. No, I'm not talking about MacBooks. I'm talking about something else that Apple's moving into that really is going to, I think, change the landscape of a certain industry. So I want to touch on that. I also want to talk about banking, global banking. There's these big companies. Think of Citigroup, JP Morgan, right? Deutsche Bank, a few others as well. These are global banks. They're having a lot of trouble. They're not doing nearly as well as a lot of the domestic banks. Why is that? You would think a company with a global reach, have a lot of different revenue streams, diversified, etc., would do much better than companies that are very domestically focused. Not so. And I'm going to tell you why. And then some sweeping changes that could change your credit score, raise your credit score, hopefully. So, well, I think that was announced today by some credit bureaus, and I think that will be good to touch on as well. Now, Steve schedules 2 or 3 days each month to meet face-to-face with a small number of listeners for individual retirement reviews. He does this at our offices in Dana Point, or for those who live out of range, you can use Skype or good old telephone as well. Now, he'll be in La Jolla March 11th, that is in a couple days on Wednesday, and he'll be in San Ramon next week, which I believe is next Tuesday, followed by San Jose on the 18th, which will be next Wednesday. And to reserve your time, just go to investtalk.com, click on the schedule a meeting button, and our staff will get right back to you.
Another information source to help you improve your investing skills and gain you some stress-relieving perspective is our KPP Premium newsletter. It comes out each Friday, and one of the most popular features is our Stock Watch. At least a couple of companies are introduced to you to watch in each edition. To sign up, just go to investtalk.com today.
Let's go to Joe in San Francisco. How are you doing, Joe?
Hello, Justin. Justin, my question has to do with ETFs versus mutual funds.
Okay.
My wife and I age-wise, I guess I describe us as super seniors age-wise.
Okay.
We have almost all of our money with two major mutual fund companies, and I would say that the funds are stressing bond investments, maybe 55% to 60% versus, say, 40% stocks. But my first part of the question is, we don't move our money around much. We, withdraw when we feel we want to, that type of thing. But for someone who invests and kind of just lets us sit there, any particular advantage ETFs over mutual funds or vice versa?
Yeah, absolutely there is. Usually ETFs have lower expenses than mutual funds. That's not 100% the time, but usually the ETFs have lower expense ratios. For example, if you look at like the SPY, which is the largest, most highly traded, most commonly held ETF out there, tracks the S&P 500, its expense ratio is 9 basis points, which means 0.09% per year. So extremely, extremely low, where most equity mutual funds, you're talking probably above the 1% range. Now, I don't know what fund families you're with. Do you you want to tell me that? I can give you an idea of usually if they're high or low.
American for a smaller amount, and most of it's with Vanguard.
Okay. American is probably more on the higher end when it comes to expenses. Vanguard, those are usually pretty low. Vanguard is probably the leader in low cost. But I bet if you move all of your Vanguard mutual funds, now I'm not 100% sure, but if you moved all your Vanguard mutual funds into Vanguard ETFs, your expenses would probably drop. That would be my assumption. But if you want to send us an email, let us know what you have. We can tell you, okay, if you moved into an ETF mix, this is how much your expenses would drop. So that's something we can do for you as well. If you want to go to our website, hit contact Steve, contact Justin button, and send us an email. Thanks for calling, Joe. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein. Give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
We thank you for subscribing to our podcast, and today we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to overseas options. Could Warren Buffett be wrong about global stocks? That's our talking point next time. Be sure to join us on the next Invest Talk.
Let's go to Harish in Santa Clara. How are you doing, Harish?
I'm doing good. Thank you, Justin. How are you?
Doing well. What can I do for you?
Calling about a... Talk Southwestern Energy. Mm-hmm. I know you guys liked it some time back, mm-hmm. and I've been looking at this for almost a few months now, and mm-hmm. I wanted to wait until the earnings come out before I make a move. And ever since it's been falling. So mm-hmm. I was wondering, what is fundamentally how does it look like now, and what would be a good entry point?
Yeah, well, it's fundamentally, it still looks good. You know, the earnings are supposed to fall this year, but they're supposed to bounce back pretty strongly next year. You know, the biggest issue, this is Southwestern Energy for everybody else, is they're engaged in the exploration and production of oil and natural gas, primarily in Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, and Pennsylvania. So this is a definitely a shale name. One thing we like about it, modest amount of debt, still growing the revenue base, even though profitability is starting to take a hit, and that's expected. A lot of that's built in. It is very cheap at these prices. Technically, it's starting to worry us a little bit. I think around here in the low 20s is a great entry point. Could go lower, but it's all about energy prices. You know, how strong will energy prices be in the future? I keep saying this. If oil breaks below that 43 and change, $44 level, then watch out. You know, things could get really ugly in the oil market, and that will be the same for Southwestern Energy, a lot of energy names. So as long as it stays above that, and right now we're in the high 40s range, so we're still well above that number. And this is a cheap name. But you know, the biggest problem I have with this is that it doesn't pay a dividend. I like stocks that pay a dividend. All of our other energy exposure pays a dividend. This one is the only one that doesn't. But we still really like it, and it's cheap down here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And one quick general question, actually,
sure.
if you're okay. I've been noticing these days the price of the oil, the per barrel. It's not changing much, but it's kind of in a range now around 49 and 52-ish, but I see that these big oil companies like the ExxonMobil or the Chevrons, they keep inching down. Any reason why, when there is no change in the price there, and I didn't understand why these guys are actually, dropping slowly, though, and I see that ExxonMobil actually hit its 52-week low as of yesterday or the Friday.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely, oil is starting to stabilize, which is good, But in the short term, things can kind of diverge. Oil really hasn't broken out above, like you said, above this kind of high 40s, low $50 range that it's been in for the past couple months. And the longer it stays down here, the longer it's going to hurt these oil names. Because remember, most of them, or a lot of them, are either breaking even or are very small margins at these levels. And so the longer it stays down here, the longer they're depleting their reserves at very low prices, the harder it is to maintain their debt levels, things like that. So, you know, if oil stays at these levels, you're probably going to see a slow erosion from a lot of oil names. But if oil can get back up into the, like I said, $65, $70 range, that will be a nice sweet spot for a lot of these oil names that can still increase their production, can still produce with decent profits, and you'll see the turnaround in these names pretty rapidly. But, you know, like I said, if it stays in this $40, $50 range, that's a big problem over the long term. So that's probably why you're seeing a lot of these oil names taking a hit. And then you got to remember, ExxonMobil didn't take nearly the type of hit that a lot of other, you know, shale companies and oil service companies that they took. So it could be slightly of a delay as well in the reaction that most people didn't want to get out of the safest oil name in the world, which is ExxonMobil, and they exited the risky ones first.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Justin.
Thanks for calling, Hirsch. Now, our talking point today is about ways to change your investing bias. And there's some new research that came out from State Street Center for Applied Research, and this suggests that the folklore of that most people make investment decisions on is flawed and can lead to making unhealthy decisions. Now, investors tend to manage money and value its success assuming too short of a time frame. That's the first takeaway from this report. Now, often they look at just 1 year of results, when in actuality it takes decade-long perspective to make more sense out of it. You know, they figure what happened last year is a good idea of what is going to happen next year. And no, the odds are the research says no, it's what happened last year has a very low impact on what's going to happen going forward. You know, most people think, oh, well, if somebody, an investor or a mutual fund or whatever, underperforms the S&P, well, that's a bad investment. Well, what about over a 5-10 year time horizon? Even 10 or 15 is probably more appropriate. So, you know, investors give too much weight to past performance, and even though it's a poor indicator of future performance. Okay, so that's the start of the takeaway of this new research, and I'm going to get to some more coming up on the show. Now, coming up in the next half hour, we want to talk more about profitability. Give us a call, 888-99-CHART. Let's go to Jim in San Francisco. How are you doing, Jim?
Oh, hi, Justin. My question is about AT&T.
Okay.
I'm attracted to it because of its dividend. Mm-hmm. And I've been...
Say that again? You think what?
It sounds like we're getting stepped on by an advertisement here.
Oh, okay. So you want to look at AT&T. So you're after that 5.6% dividend, right?
Right, but I see that the price-to-earnings ratio is about 28.
That's not what I'm seeing. We have a price-to-earnings ratio of 13. I don't know where you're getting 28. They're supposed to make $2.54 this year and $2.60 next year. So that puts the P/E ratio going forward. Let's do a quick calculation. If we go, it's trading at $30.35 today. And if it makes $2.60 next year, that's right about that 13 range, where it's at now. Obviously, there's not a lot of revenue or not a lot of earnings growth. 1% earnings growth this year, 2% projected for next year. So this is not a growing company, or at least not in any dramatic fashion. And I wouldn't expect it to be.
Right.
They operate in a pretty saturated market. The cost of new spectrum is going up. So it's an expensive place to be, but obviously you have a huge revenue base, and their profitability is very strong. Now, why AT&T versus maybe something like Verizon? Another, you know, the kind of the other large. Now, obviously the dividend's 4.6%. We are getting 9% earnings growth this year, 6% next year. Any reason?
Does the horizon look more attractive?
I would say it does, just because of that revenue growth. They have stronger profitability, and they've, you know, it's a carrier that has a better reputation, I think. So we're invested in Verizon over AT&T. Mm-hmm. Their profitability is better. Their growth is better. The biggest issue with Verizon is their debt. Their debt level is a lot bigger than AT&T, but they also operate in a sector where it's not a lot of volatility. Even if you go in recession, I think people are still going to be paying their cell phone bills and wanting to have a cell phone. So, and I think Verizon and AT&T will stay the dominant players in this sector for a long time. Now, the biggest issue with both is that it is a sector that has increasing competition. So that's an issue. But you know, I would rather be in Verizon than AT&T. I don't think either are bad investments. But if you're really more worried about the dividend, which is better on the AT&T than Verizon, then you know, that might be the better way to go. I don't think that's gonna go anywhere. But if you're looking for a better long-term investment that has better growth prospects, better profitability, etc., I think Verizon's a better play.
Well, thank you for that information. I appreciate it.
No problem, Jim. Thanks for calling. Now, before the break, I talked about investment biases and how most people, they use the wrong figures to evaluate success of any type of investment. They look at what happened in the last year, which is a bad indicator of future performance. What else do? They talk about beating the market and posting gains with no losses, which are both irrelevant or impossible. Don't ever think that you're going to have an investment that has no risk. I hear people, there's one guy I talked to, this was a few months back, and he asked me, he knows I'm in the investment world, and said, you know, I forgot what firm he was with, but he said, oh, my guy's getting me 8% a year. I go, oh, okay, that's great. I think he's been with him maybe a year. And I said, you know, what, you know what he's in? Oh, I don't know what he's in. So he had no idea what type of risk he's taking. He's like, well, so what are you getting? Well, I said, it depends on, you know, what type of risk you want to take. You know, there's low risk, there's medium risk, there's high risk, and different shades of all of those. And so he said, well, I want 8% but low risk. I said, well, in this environment, you're not getting 8% with low risk. Well, my guy's giving me 8%. Well, yeah, because market's good. You know, during the last year, getting 8% is not terribly hard if you take the right risks. But a lot of people, they think, okay, I gave 8%, that's great. But risk adjusted, what type of risk are you taking to get that 8%? Are you taking a lot of risk? A little bit of risk. So it all really depends, okay? So, you know, saying that you can beat the market with no losses, no investment losses or potential for investment losses, unrealistic. And a lot of times beating the market is just not relevant to personal goals, which I think is extremely important, extremely important. Now, what are the things that you can do to change these type of behaviors? Well, the first thing is to incorporate a devil's advocate type of approach to your decision-making process to avoid falling victim to groupthink, right? So if you hear someone else making this investment and they're doing well, what are the risks involved in that? And vice versa. You see an investment that is done poorly, well, what if you can find the silver lining in a particular asset class and look for opportunity? So it can work both ways. It doesn't have to be thinking about the negative, but also thinking about the positive in light of, you know, a negative situation for any particular investment. Number two, keep a diary of your investment decisions and keep track of what ultimately led to the success or failure. Study your investment decisions. Number three, develop a trading discipline with rules, buying and selling. And make sure what you are investing in is right for your temperament and your needs. And number four is tweak your asset allocation to suit your own psychological tendencies. So if you're somebody who stock goes down 5 or 10%, you said, oh, that's too much risk or too much volatility, I want to be out. Well, maybe you shouldn't be in names that tend to be that volatile regularly. Right? There's plenty of asset classes that tend to have high volatility. If you can't handle that 5, 10% loss on a particular name, well, you should probably stick with utilities and telecom companies. Okay? So try not to have this short-term way of thinking of, okay, what happened last year is a good indication of whether this investment is good or bad. Try not to say, oh, well, if this other investment did better than this one I have now, well, this other one is better, for sure. Well, not necessarily. Just because it's better today doesn't mean it's going to be better tomorrow. And it also doesn't mean that is appropriate for you. What if you need low volatility, want low volatility? Your investment psyche is for low volatility. And your amount of assets you have and your goals call for low volatility investments. Well, going over to this other investment that just because it did a little bit better, performance-wise, over a short period of time, doesn't mean that it's a better investment. And doesn't mean it's appropriate for you. So matching those two things up is extremely, extremely important as well. And that's something we do for clients, trying to assess their risk and where they need to be. They need to be conservative. They need to be aggressive. They need to have somewhere in between. If you don't have that perspective, then you're going to make not only bad investment decisions, but just inappropriate investment decisions. And that's ultimately is the first line of defense for any investment decision is this appropriate for you? Now, if you haven't joined our Invest Talk Insider program, I have one question for you. Why not? There's no cost at all, and your membership gives you instant access to all sorts of informational extras, including our library of webinars, stock or chart lessons, lists of ETFs of different sectors, things that people need to make good investment decisions. And if you want to sign up for free to become one of those InvestTalk insiders, you can just go to investtalk.com.
A quick reminder, if there's a term that you hear mentioned on the program but you're unclear about what it means or you have a question about it, we want you to ask. It's very likely that you're not the only one with that same question. 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Steve, Justin, this is Brian Wood. I'm a podcast listener in Atlanta, Georgia. I've got a position in a stock I'd like your opinion on. It seems like it's had a real good run-up lately, but got some questions about the, looks like the PE's out of whack to me. The company is Vulcan Materials, Vector Mary Charlie, VMC. Appreciate your opinion. Thanks.
Vulcan Materials, VMC, V as in Victor, M as in Mary, C as in Charles, is the symbol. They produce construction aggregates, asphalt mix, and concrete for the construction and paving industries. Now, this is a name as very volatile profitability. 2008, they made $1.74, went all the way down to losing 93 cents a share in 2011, and they've slowly built their way back up to improving profitability each and every year since then. And this year they're supposed to make $2.02. Next year, $3.20. Big grower, big grower. PE is about 90. If you base it by next year's projected earnings, remember this is just projected, but analysts they usually are pretty good in the ballpark. Obviously not specifics, but it could probably be in the ballpark. If you go with $3.20 a share, trading at $84 a share right now, it's a 26 PE. So that's that's above average, but I wouldn't say it's dramatically overvalued by any sense. The biggest issue is that revenue is growing only 11% year over year, 7% the quarter before, and the few quarters before that as well. So, you know, it's still only growing high single digits, low double digits in revenue growth, but earnings are growing pretty dramatically. So I wonder, how are they doing that? How are they creating strong profitability and choppy profitability, even though revenue growth isn't going up dramatically? So I want to dig into that a little deeper. I wouldn't say it's super overvalued. I would say it's probably close to fairly valued, if you want me to be frank, maybe slightly undervalued. Modest amount of debt, I like that. Let me go a little bit deeper into the numbers. You know, free cash flow is still pretty low, $35 million on a company that's now $11 billion market cap. So free cash flow is pretty low. Profitability is still also pretty low, 5% return on equity. I don't really like that. So, you know, they're in a good trajectory. Profitability is improving, but how high can that get? This is one of those names that it's doing well, but what's the limit of that doing well? Or as they get bigger, the comps from last year and the previous quarters get a lot harder, the comparables, I mean. And that can be difficult to maintain that type of growth. So if you've had a big run, I would take a little bit off table and keep a trailing stop on it, you know, 10% or so, and let it run, because it's still, I would say, slightly undervalued, but there's a lot of risk to this name. Now time for Invest Talk 101, Lessons in Basic Investing Strategies. Return on assets is one of the many important measurements of a company's value to investors. Now, when calculating return on equity, you must first find the return on assets. Now, once return on assets is determined, you find the amount of financial leverage a company is holding, meaning debt. And the typical return on asset levels vary between industries. For example, retail and food companies tend to have single-digit return on assets. But many technology companies carry figures into the double digits. Now, why is that? So I'll break down we broke down return on equity between return on assets and leverage, right? Well, leverage is pretty simple. That's about the debt to equity ratio. Then you look at return on assets. That can be broken down into two other numbers. One is margins, right? What are their profit margins? And then their turnover, right? How many times are they selling their products every year? If you have low margins but huge volume, you're turning over your inventory all the time, well, you're going to make a lot of money. You can have huge margins and sell your product once a year and not make a ton of money. Right? So all these different things matter. So that's why retail and food companies tend to have low return on assets, because guess what? Their margins are very low. Margins in that industry is very low. And technology companies, their margins tend to be very large, but a lot of times they only make that sale once. Banks have very low levels of return on assets because they rely on leverage to sustain that profitability. That was one of the big issues with the financial crisis, right? Return on assets they fell dramatically because you're having losses. And had the phone go off on us. Now, banks have very low return on assets because they rely on leverage, like I said. And with high debt loads, they create large leverage, which can skew the return on equity levels. Now, it's important that companies have healthy and rising return on assets, because if that declines, so will profitability. And eventually, debt loads will no longer be manageable. And that's what happened in the financial crisis. They had huge debt loads, huge leverage, very low return on assets. But it made it look like, that leverage made it look like they were very profitable. And all of a sudden, return on asset goes away, and now that leverage amplifies their losses the other way, and companies go bankrupt. So that's Invest Talk 101. If you have a question about that, give us a call or go to investtalk.com, click on Contact Justin.
Our Invest Talk podcast distribution is made possible by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. And Steve hopes you'll sign up for our free wealth webinar coming up March 19th, The Upside of Lower Oil Prices. And again, it's coming March 19th at 6 Pacific Time, 6 p.m. The sign up is free on investtalk.com.
$88.99 chart, $88.992, 4278. We have about 5 minutes left in the show, so if you're going to call, call in now. So Apple had their event today, and they announced a few things. First, they announced a new MacBook that's thinner and has a new keyboard and looks amazing. It comes in different colors now, not just the silver. I think you can get in gray and gold now, which is kind of cool. But that really wasn't the highlight, as expected. And I'll talk a little about the Apple Watch, but at the end I want to talk quickly about another announcement they have. I think it can have some major disruptions in the industry. First, let's go over what the Apple Watch is. Well, first, it goes on sale April 24th. Pre-orders begin April 10th, about a month from now. It'll be available in 9 different countries: Australia, Canada, China, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Japan, and in the UK, as well as here. The cheapest Apple Watch will be the 38mm Sport model, which is $349. The 42mm Sport will be $399. Presumably, you know, the 38mm is for the women, 42mm is for the men's watch. And then you have the regular Apple Watch, starts around $500, and then you have the Apple Watch Edition, which I think is a really weird name, but will start at $10,000 and cost as much as $17,000 for the very, very top-of-the-line model, interesting enough. And it will last about 18 hours on a full charge. There will be 3 models, like I said: Apple Watch Sport, the Apple Watch, and the Apple Watch Edition. The Apple Watch Sport will be made of aluminum. The Apple Watch will be made of stainless steel. And the Apple Watch Edition will be made of 18-karat gold. Obviously, that's why it's worth so much, or costs so much. There are only two buttons on the whole watch. What else? What else do we got? It comes in 2 different sizes. You're going to need an iPhone 5 or newer to connect to the internet, use it for internet-based applications that are going to run on it. It'll be available in 2 colors for each one: the stainless steel and black stainless steel for the Apple Watch, silver and gray aluminum for the Apple Watch Sport, and yellow gold and rose gold for the Apple Watch Edition. There are going to be 6 types of wristbands for it, for each one. You can use it to work out. It's going to have an accelerometer, a heart rate sensor, but no GPS. So that's kind of the rundown of the Apple Watch. Steve thinks it's going to be a big success. I think the jury's still out. I'm an Apple user. I have a Mac Mini at home. I have an iPhone. And I'm not seeing the value add here, the value proposition for this device. I don't see the innovation yet that could come. I think it likely will come at some point, but maybe not this edition. Maybe it's the next editions. Maybe it's an app that needs to come out, a company that creates a killer app for the Apple Watch that makes it so amazing. So I think the jury is still out on whether it's going to be a huge success or not. But the one of the bigger announcements, I think, coming started the event today, and that was about, first off, Apple lowering the price of the Apple TV to $69 from $99. That's about a 30% drop in the cost of Apple TV, which I think is huge. And now they announced the HBO Now. There's HBO Go, which is an online version of your subscription through your cable provider. Now it's going to be HBO Now. It's the first ever standalone HBO streaming package. And it will be available on Apple devices very soon. And Apple and HBO struck a deal. Starting in early April, the $14.99 monthly service will be let users stream HBO movies and TV shows on iPads, iPhones, Apple TV without having to sign up for a cable subscription at all. It's the first time HBO has allowed a standalone service, but they announced this last year. But it's pretty big. And I think it's just the start. It's already started. But the end of your cable bill, I think, is just a few years away, and Apple knows it, the industry knows it, the content providers know it. It's just a matter of time, and it's something you should look out for if you own cable companies. It could be an issue. Before we close the hour, you can register now for our free webinar coming up on the 19th. of this month at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. We've expanded it to 90 minutes, so we'll have more time for Q&A at the end. And we'll examine the world of world oil economics, OPEC versus oil producers versus the rest of the world, how politics play into this economic tug-of-war, the countries that will benefit and those that will suffer in a world of lower oil prices, and how you can profit as well. Register now at InvestTalk.com. I'm Portfolio Manager Justin Klein. If it's Steve Peasley and everyone at KP Financial, I thank you for listening today. See you tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing.